So nice to have you back, Dimitri.
Good to be with you.
I hope we're not going to have any sort of noise today.
I hope so too.
Yeah.
Did everything I could.
Yeah. And let's get started, Dimitri, with I want to talk about the situation between Russia and NATO. But before that, we have something so strange going on in the Middle East. How do you find right now the way that Israelis are trying to attack Hezbollah by using these pagers, walkie-talkies, these bombing, these new type of bombings?
Well, it looks like Mossad was able to infiltrate the process of making batteries, so that the batteries, which are the most substantial kind of black box item in most of these modern devices, be they electric cars or pagers or what have you, so that they're part battery and part explosive. And they figured out a way to make them explode by issuing certain commands over the air, over the airways. And so this may be efficient from the point of view of the Israelis, because they blew up some number of Hezbollah people or hurt them, some of them even killed, blew the arms off people, killed one 9-year-old girl, etc. But that's nothing for them. They're in genocide mode anyway. But what this has done, and this is part of the story that everyone seems to be missing until now, is that, the United States is no longer a sovereign nation, because it's basically its government is stalked by transnational corporations that keep their cash offshore, don't pay taxes, etc. But the U.S. government is also run by the Israelis. So it's sort of a split brain patient, if you will, the U.S. is. Part of its sovereignty has gone away to transnational corporations, and part of its sovereignty has gone away to Israel, which owns half of the U.S. Senate and has infiltrated special services to a great extent in the United States. As a result of these pagers and phones and electric mopeds and what have you blowing up because of Mossad building explosives into the battery packs, is that they're no longer really popular with the transnational corporations, especially the technology corporations. Companies like Apple, companies like Google, all the big ones, Meta, have spent an inordinate amount of capital convincing people to keep close to their electronic devices at all times, keep them on their bedstead at night as they sleep, keep them in their pocket as they walk down the street. You see hardly a woman walking down the street wearing jeans without a phone sticking out of the back pocket. Now, as of yesterday, the day before, whenever that happened, these people now know that these things could explode at any time at the whim of some crazy Israeli operative. That does not make people comfortable with these electronic devices. So that does two things. One is, down the drain goes this giant investment by technology companies to make people love and fondle their little electronic devices. That's one. And two, big technology players like Russia, India, and China have now understood that they have to really sever ties to Western technology, literally blockade it. And so that doesn't sound very good at all if you're one of the Western technology companies. So this is another civil war brewing, in addition to the one between the pseudo-Republicans and the pseudo-Democrats in the United States. This one will be between the transnational technology companies and sovereign technology companies in countries like China and Russia. And so that's a very interesting development, where you basically, the Israelis, they burnt down the house to get rid of the cockroaches. That's basically what they did. not a very good plan, not very smart. Jews are supposed to be smart people, and look what they did.
Yeah. But in your opinion, are they trying to intimidate Hezbollah, and that would work in their vision, in the way that they're thinking of? Because right now, it doesn't seem that would work for them.
No, it's like poking a hornet's nest with a stick. You know, not a smart thing to do. These people want to martyr themselves. You know, Hezbollah, what does that mean? Slave of God? I think that's the translation. I don't think they care whether they get killed or not, as long as they take some Israelis with them. So now they're a little bit more mad than they were before. Is that a good result? I don't think so.
But do you find it as a sign of escalation between Israel and Hezbollah? Because right now we know that Israel desperately wants to attack Hezbollah. And they're doing right now. They're bombing the southern part of Lebanon as we talk. And they did this attack as well. This pager and walkie-talkie, this electronic. And at the end of the day, in your opinion, they're seeking to intimidate, or they're seeking for some sort of escalation?
Well, look, a lot of different parts of the world, a lot of different players are waiting for certain other players to curl up and die. That goes for Israel, that goes for the Ukraine, that goes for the United States. If you check out the financial position of the United States, it's basically going to go bye-bye. I don't remember the exact numbers, but the amount of debt that needs to be rolled over the next year exceeds the total revenues of the U.S. government. You could call that an unhealthy situation, or if you regard the United States as a company, it's bankrupt. It's basically, it's done. Same thing with Israel. Its biggest port, Eilat, is bankrupt. It's bankrupt. But shipments are not getting in because the Houthis are either threatening to kill them, or if that doesn't work, actually killing them as they traverse or attempt to traverse the Red Sea. Israel is losing lots of money. Its GDP is down 18% year on year right now, or 19%, something like that. For a little government, for a little fragile economy, that's deadly. Tourism is completely gone. It's losing population because people realize what's going on, and the smart people are heading for the airport, especially the smart people with multiple passports. So Israel is being hollowed out. It's losing militarily. Everybody expects the United States to not be able to keep supplying it with weapons, as has already happened with the Ukraine. And so everybody wants to wait for these players to just croak on their own. That explains the stance that Iran has taken, where it wanted to, on the one hand, it wanted some kind of retribution, some kind of revenge. On the other hand, it realized that the best revenge is just sitting there and waiting for Israel to dry up and blow away. And so both Israel and the Ukraine are hatching schemes for some kind of a glorious death, as opposed to just drying up and blowing away, because there's just no glory in that at all. And that explains all of these absolutely desperate moves. We're going to see even more desperate moves on behalf of this trio, Israel, the Ukraine, and the United States. I wouldn't be surprised if the terrorists in Washington decide to blow up a truck bomb and kill Trump's entire family. After all, a third of the U.S. population is in favor of killing Trump, so why not proceed there? And after that, does the United States stay united or not? Probably not. Similar things happening with the Ukrainians. Similar things are happening with Israel. We should wait for more terrorism and more escalation from these players.
Yeah. And talking about Ukraine and the situation that we're in Ukraine right now, how did you find this visit of Stormer to the United States? And in your opinion, it seems that they wanted to send long-range missiles to Ukraine, Europeans. I'm talking specifically the United Kingdom and France. And as we've learned later, Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, was in favor of this decision. But it seems that the Biden administration was not totally in line with them. And they didn't decide to do that. How did you find it?
Well, they're all playing this game of let's nod and say we did. And they could say, okay, attack Russia. And that would be kind of bad, because here they are daring Putin to put an end to them, to their misery. That doesn't look very good. Or they could stand down, and that would look weak. And their electorate would think, well, why are we spending all this money on defense if it's so pointless? So their option is to do none of the above. So the Americans just aren't very sure. And let's think about it. That's their stance. And they could keep thinking about it until Biden is out of office or dead or whatever. And the Brits, their stance was, we'll pretty much wait for the Americans to give us the okay. And so the okay is never going to come. And in the meantime, there are even more ridiculous plans being sort of batted about. Zelensky has mapped out a road to victory, of all things. Just absolutely ridiculous, just to have something to talk about. And of course, this road to victory involves, I don't know what kinds of strikes against Russia. And meanwhile, you know, the people who are trying to recruit, or, you know, basically grab people off the street and threaten to kill them unless they go to me, that whole effort is going worse than ever, because the cars of the recruiters are getting torched. Now it's dozens of cars all over the Ukraine every night going up in flames. So these people are now going around on foot and actually physically dragging people to the recruitment offices. And the number of people who just basically get delivered to the front line and then walk away is going up and up and up. So it doesn't look like victory, but they're going to talk about their plan for absolute total victory over Russia until somebody with a hook reaches from backstage and pulls them off by the neck.
You talk about the victory plan on the part of Zelensky. They were talking with Biden administration, with the Biden administration. But one of the points that was mentioned in this, that Zelensky and his administration, they're waiting, they're asking for some sort of invitation for Ukraine to be part of NATO before Biden leaving office in the United States. Do you think that Biden would do that for them?
No. I don't think anybody is that insane. I don't think even Biden, in his delicate state of mental health, would go for you know, accepting into NATO with all of the responsibilities of NATO membership, a country that is freshly defeated and freshly defeated after being trained and equipped with NATO weapons and to NATO standards, and helped with all kinds of mercenaries and private military companies. This is the latest an American private military company blundered into the Kursk region and got decimated by the Russians within hours of reaching their destination. So even that's not helping. And the Russians are really just having a field day perfecting their weapons systems and are using the Ukrainians for target practice. They now know how to destroy just about every piece of NATO armament that's out there without putting any of their own military assets at risk. So that's a beautiful scenario as far as Russia's concerned. There'll be lots of weapons sales coming along shortly, and plus the victory. And there's a major date coming up, the 80th anniversary of World War II victory on May 9th of 2025, with a big, huge celebration in Moscow. And taking over and just completely destroying the Kiev regime and having the Americans sort of walk away and pretend that the Ukraine never existed anyway would be icing on the cake as far as the Russians are concerned. So things are going in that direction, and that's fine for Russia, and that's terrible for the United States. So what is the United States going to do? Escalate and lose everything, or cut its losses as it always does? After all, the United States always fights wars for money. So what money is there in the Ukraine? Yes, BlackRock has bought up all of this real estate and a few other major American investment companies. But those deeds are going up in flames as they speak. You know, that those deeds that they somehow procured without gaining any kind of a consent from the Ukrainians themselves as to the sale of their sovereign land to foreign entities, I don't think that those deeds are going to be worth anything at all. So might as well write that off too. And, you know, it's a sad story, but cutting their losses is something that Americans know how to do. So that's what I would expect them to do.
And how about the European Union right now? Do you think that do you find any sort of unity in terms of sending long-range missiles to Ukraine, or it's just about France and United Kingdom together once they want to do that, and Germany, because we haven't heard from Germany so far specifically about this issue?
Well, look, they would love to continue serving their American masters, the people in power, that is, because that's what they've been conditioned and trained to do. That's all they know how to do. On the other hand, they do have these pesky constituents in the countries in question, you know, the French people, the German people, the Brits, and they somehow have to take care of them, or at least pretend to, at least govern the place so that people just don't start dying in droves. And as it turns out, the United States has stopped selling liquefied natural gas to Europe. So now most of the liquefied natural gas comes from Russia. So they shut down or blow up the pipelines, and now they're paying more for liquefied natural gas, because that's better than just going without and shutting everything down. And in general, they're coming to an understanding that the United States can't help them, because the United States doesn't own the United States. Some transnational companies do, and they're going to maximize their revenue. They're not really all that interested in these politics. They're interested in revenue. So the reason that liquefied natural gas didn't go to Europe from the United States is there was more money to be made by shipping it to the Pacific Rim, to China and various other countries. And so that's an example of how America functions. It says it will do one thing, but then it says, oops, it's more profitable somewhere else. And the Europeans are forced to come to that understanding, because the alternative is freezing to death and lights out, etc. And so taking the example of France, for instance, it depends on nuclear power to a great extent from its rather elderly nuclear power plants, and it's the most dependent on Russian enriched uranium. It was enough for Putin to say, why are we selling these strategic assets to our enemies, to make the price of uranium go up appreciably. And the French, and it made the French realize that if they really step out of the way to hurt Russia on behalf of the Ukrainians or whoever, then it's going to be lights out in France. And that's going to be really, really bad for them. And that's going to make them, the elites, even less popular and cause even more political mayhem. So that is a major limiting factor on going to war against Russia, with or without Ukrainian help or whatever. And so the realization is sinking in. Now, Putin a little while ago stood in the arch of the victory arch that was built to commemorate the victory in the Napoleonic War, which was an interesting place for him to stand. And said that, you know, acts of war by launching long range rockets against targets in Russia proper, not the Donbas, not the formerly Ukrainian regions, would be an act of war, and there would be a response. Some people were saying that, well, the Europeans heard that and the Americans heard that, but the effect will wear off in 2 weeks. Well, we'll have to see whether that is true or not. I expect that there will be some residual effect.
How, in your opinion, the message of Putin right after this decision, that we've heard that they're trying to make a decision to send these long-range missiles to Ukraine, but after that, Putin said that if you do that, we're going to attack you, we're going to respond to you. Do you think that was the main reason that Washington and Pentagon decided not to send these missiles to Ukraine, or something beyond that, behind the scene or through back channels they're talking about these things?
I think it's much more straightforward than that. These rockets have been flying, and they've been attacking Crimea and various other regions. The rockets are there, the missiles are there in the Ukraine already. The crews that launched them are already there in the Ukraine and have been programming and arming those missiles. Maybe there's a Ukrainian to push the big button, but that doesn't really matter. The Ukrainians, as Putin pointed out, don't know how to operate these weapons. They don't. So it's not them. It's NATO countries that would be shooting at Russia, and therefore it would be a war between NATO and Russia. Forget Ukraine. It has nothing to do with Ukraine. Ukraine is just territory occupied, temporarily occupied by the United States. That's all it is. Zero sovereignty, zero decision-making potential or ability. So Putin basically said that, you know, if it's war, then it's war, and our response will be whatever it has to be to put an end to this. And that made people pay attention. Now, what they said to each other and whether there were any back channels, I can tell you with absolute certainty that there were no back channels, that there was no secret negotiation between the Russians and the Americans or the Europeans or whoever, because Putin doesn't do things that way. Putin is the master of public diplomacy. He announces his decisions to the people before he announces them to the elites that he's supposedly going to negotiate with. That drives the Americans and the Europeans absolutely insane, because their idea of diplomacy is by secret deals. They're pre-programmed for corruption. And so here they're dealing with somebody who is incorruptible. How can they possibly deal with somebody like that? And that may explain some of the complete lack of understanding between them, but that's where it stands.
Yeah. And the other aspect of this conflict, Dmitry, would be, how the European Union is thinking of this conflict, because when you look at the latest debate, the debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, even with Kamala Harris, she was saying that she would support Ukraine if she wins. But you don't see that sort of certainty in her talk when she was talking about it. Donald Trump is totally against the conflict in Ukraine. And at the end of the day, we know that those people behind the scene are taking these decisions. But it seems that there, as you mentioned, there is nothing coming out of Ukraine in favor of just the United States economically. How do you see right now the way that they're talking about and the way that the European Union is perceiving what's going on in the United States? Because recently there is an article in Bloomberg, they're talking about that the United States would leave Europe alone with what has happened in Ukraine, and they have to manage the situation. It doesn't matter if Kamala Harris wins or Donald Trump. And do you feel that the European Union understand? Does the European Union understand what's going on in the United States? Considering even Bloomberg is talking about it, how do they feel about it in your opinion? Or they're not willing to think in this way?
I think that thinking of the European Union as an entity having a brain is what's called misplaced concreteness, the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, because there is no such brain. There are just a bunch of useless people, and most of them are just talking past each other most of the time. So what is of interest to the Europeans that you can see in their behavior, starting with Germany, and now it has spread to a few other countries, such as the Netherlands? They're shutting their borders, supposedly because of refugees. Is there a huge flood of refugees right now coming in that calls for such measures? No, they already let in the refugees. They already have a huge refugee problem, right? So that's like shutting the doors of the barn after the horse has escaped. That's what they're doing. So why are they doing that now? Because only a stupid person doesn't understand that there's going to be millions of refugees pouring out of the former Ukraine as soon as the Kiev regime falls, which it will. Between 3 and 5 million Ukrainians will pour into the European Union and claim refugee status, political refugee status. Look, we're escaping from the Russians. And given what the Europeans have been saying all along until now, with the sanctions packages against Russia and all of this anti-Russia rhetoric, they won't be able to say, no, you're not political refugees. You're just riffraff. You're just looking for a handout. No, we won't let you in. So what they want to do instead is make it somebody else's problem. They can't just say, no, we won't take any refugees at all. They will say, the countries that have to take the refugees are the first European Union country that those refugees touch. So if a Ukrainian ends up in Slovakia, that's Slovakia's problem, not Germany's problem, etc. That's what they're trying to build up to. And they're in absolute agony as far as putting that through. Of course, nobody in Brussels wants to hear anything about it. They're happy. They just figured out how to get more women into the governorship of the European Union. Ursula von der Leyen got some more women in there. That makes her happy. Next step will be to get some transgenders in there, because that'll make her even happier, you know. And so that's what she's interested in. She's not interested in suddenly pushing through emergency measures to deal with emigration, especially seeing as that has to be done by by European consensus. Everybody has to vote on it. And the thing is that, okay, Germany will vote on shutting borders and making this new rule that wherever the refugees first land in the European Union, that's where they become refugees. That's where they're granted status. But all of the peripheral nations, you know, Greece, Romania, Bulgaria, Slovakia, Poland, they'll be up in arms about that because they don't want those Ukrainians. In fact, they would like to kick out the Ukrainians that they already got because they don't get along with them. So that's what's going on with the European Union. And that's going to be the big issue, the big problem is 3 to 5 million Ukrainians, possibly more, that probably would have some kind of criminal proceedings against them by the Russians if they stick around. Whereas if they manage to insinuate themselves into the European Union, they become political refugees as opposed to terrorists. Big difference. And so a lot of people will try to do that.
Yeah. Another outcome of this conflict in Ukraine was they were talking about that how Russia and China are getting closer to each other. And right now, Bloomberg reported that the United States, together with the United Kingdom, are concerned about a possible nuclear deal between Iran and Russia. And do you find these concerns legitimate?
No, I don't find these concerns legitimate. They're trying to generate some kind of energy by flapping their lips. That's all that means. Iran has a standing fatwa against nuclear weapons. What more do you need to know? Which part of the Iranian government will violate the fatwa first? Tell me that. Which Iranian official is going to violate the fatwa in international negotiations with Russia? Is there such a person? I doubt that such a person exists. Therefore, this is just noise.
Yeah, but in your opinion, what's going on between these three countries, Iran, China, and Russia? And is it possible for the United States to make some sort of division between them, or it's totally out of hand of the United States, considering what they can do with India, what they can do with Turkey, and all these players that are still playing in their hands?
Well, look, you have two countries that are symbionts. So Russia has a huge market for all kinds of things that the Chinese make. China is a huge market for all kinds of things that the Russians make. And they work together. They trade in their own currencies, completely circumvented the US dollar and the euro in trade. Their big plan is to sign lots and lots of agreements and grow their bilateral trade by huge amounts, which is what they're doing. There are lots of contacts on the level of culture and education. St. Petersburg is a university city, lots of universities here, lots of Chinese students, and lots of Russians are learning Chinese. So the two countries are melding. Now if you're a Russian, you learn English because that's what they teach in schools, but there's always an after-school program where you can learn Chinese as well. Lots of kids in my family, to my surprise, have suddenly realized that their job prospects will be so much better if they learn Chinese in addition to English. So that'll be the most important foreign language in Russia moving forward. So these are things that are actually happening. And then, like I said, Americans are making mouth music about, oh my God, we pushed Russia and China close together. Well, maybe the United States had something to do with inspiring that, but there are lots of other inspirational moments, let's put it that way, that have nothing to do with the United States. And when the Americans say, well, we have to somehow, that vice president guy, Trump's vice president pick,
J.D. Vance.
J.D. Vance, yeah. I'm surprised that he even opens his mouth about these things. Has he been to China or Russia? You know, does he know those languages? He seems like a bit of a hick. But anyway, he goes on about how Ukraine doesn't matter, but what we should really be doing is driving a wedge between Russia and China. And both the Russians and the Chinese look at him and think, cuckoo, empty head, has nothing to do with reality.
How do they find it, the new president of Iran in Russia? And do they really think that Iran is changing any sort of policy, or they're pretty same as they were before?
Well, I forget his name, but first act in office was to say that nothing.
His name is Masoud Pezeshkian. Pezeshkian,
yes.
Yeah.
I thought he was Armenian at first, but...
it's Iran.
He's Iranian. So Pezeshkian, first thing he said was that he wasn't going to change anything after Raisi. Things would stay the same. And then after that, he followed up on that promise by doing exactly that, not changing anything. So all the deals that were moving through, an entire raft of bilateral deals between Russia and China, they're moving through. So a lot of very seemingly tricky things, like Russia farming out weapons manufacturing to Iran. That's moving through. So nothing has changed. Nothing at all.
Yeah. And it seems that they're getting, in terms of their economy, how do you find, it seems that they're getting along, they're trying to find some sort of solution to have not only between Russia and China, but all these countries, Iran as well, Azerbaijan, maybe, because it's part of that project that goes from the north to the south. And how do you find that project right now? Is that, are they going to do something substantially in this coming BRICS summit in Kazan?
Well, I think it's separate from the BRICS summit, but I think the paperwork has been pretty well signed and worked out, and it's all about the details. It's a huge project, lots of coordination, but it's happening. There'll be a corridor that will bypass the Suez Canal and Gibraltar, and will make the U.S. Navy kind of irrelevant in terms of keeping the sea lanes open, which it is already, given its wonderful performance in Yemen and in keeping the Red Sea and the Suez Canal safe for Israeli-bound shipping. So this is another project that basically completely sidelines the former maritime empires of Great Britain and the United States, and it's moving forward. I don't think it particularly has to do with the BRICS summit. There are a lot of other issues to sort out at the BRICS summit. I'm waiting to see what do about the unit and about this project of basically making bilateral currency transactions in trade kind of transparent, sort of building these wormholes, these financial wormholes between different economies so that nobody has to mint extra money to fund foreign trade. And nobody has to even touch the dollar or the euro in order to trade with other BRICS members. That's a good plan. Lots of details to be worked out, in particular, how to price the unit. And we should expect some details of, I hope to hear some details about that from the summit. That's probably the most important thing going on there.
Cuban ambassador to Russia confirmed that Cuban president received an invitation to the BRICS summit in Kazan. And how important Cuba is for Russia right now?
I don't know that you could say that it's strategically particularly important, because Russia doesn't really need a land base close to the United States in order to reliably destroy the United States using nuclear weapons. It also doesn't need it for any other purpose. It has lots of other ways of reaching the United States mainland if the United States decides to actually pick a fight with Russia, not through a proxy like the Ukraine, but directly. And so Cuba is a project that started under the Soviet Union. There's a great deal of love and affection between the peoples. Cuba is a favorite destination for Russians who want to spend some time on the beach, although expensive because of the airline tickets being rather expensive. And wonderful place for the Russians to visit, because here you come to a place where everybody absolutely loves you. All you have to do is put a little Russian flag on yourself somewhere and you'll just get the most wonderful treatment imaginable. So the Russians certainly love that. And also, you know, in spite of all of the economic difficulties that Cuba experiences, all of the shortages because of the blockade, the problem of having everything shipped in from far away and therefore more expensive, all of that, and that sort of creaky socialist regime that they have, where there's inevitably a bit of corruption and inevitably a bit of heavy-handedness on the part of the government to fight that corruption, or at least keep it in check somehow. In spite of all that, there are some joint projects between Russia and Cuba, economic projects, that are moving forward pretty well, such as building tractors, just as an example. So there's a lot of good emotion between Russia and Cuba, as is between Russia and Nicaragua, Russia and Venezuela, etc. And so the Russians make use of that to the greatest extent possible, because that's Russia's soft power to a great extent. It's not so much even that, you know, there's a military advantage in having these nations as allies as there is in having them as friends.
Yeah. To wrap up this session, Dmitry, we've learned that in Burkina Faso that Russia is there right now. And the Islamists, these radical Islamists, are attacking the government. And in your opinion, who's behind this type of activities in Burkina Faso?
I don't know.
Nobody knows. Because everything we talk about, something in Russia, in this conflict, in these radical Islam is just popping up and doing something. It's unbelievable. And yeah.
Radical Islam is an American project. Islamic terrorism is an American project. So if that pops up somewhere in the world, look for the CIA. Standing right behind, giving it training, weapons, brainwashing people, etc.
Yeah.
But that's just the rule of thumb.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dmitry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.